This is Rage, Radio Against Global Ecocide. Today on the show, Derek Jensen, talking about storytelling and the effects of the stories we are being told. Music by a group of artists that Derek quotes all the time. Can you guess who? And music by Focus. This is Rage, building a community of resistance one podcast at a time. Hello, and welcome to Rage, Radio Against Global Ecocide, coming to you from occupied Amiskwasi, Wiskaigan. I am your host, Seymour Life. And a special hello to all those out there confronting the insanity of the dominant culture. And special kudos to anyone who caught the pun in the intro. It wasn't really intended. Today on the show, Derek Jensen. Derek is a well-known author of Endgame 1 and 2, Culture of Make-Believe, What We Leave Behind, Lives Less Valuable, and at least 12 other books that look honestly and unflinchingly at the dominant culture and its insane destruction of our home, planet Earth. I start off the interview with a big three-part question. For me, I guess, when I think about and when I talk about the culture of make-believe with other people, one of the things I talk about is how we're constantly reinforcing our world views, and just sort of wanted to get into how you felt story-making or storytelling is used to reinforce our worldviews, and also about making hatred invisible, and also thinking a lot about your last Orion article, because there's pieces of that through that article as well.
Yeah, and that's three pretty big questions, and I'd like to, I guess I'll start with the one question about storytelling first, that humans are social creatures, and as such, we learn how to behave through the stories that we receive and the stories that we witness. And if the stories that you're taught systematically objectify others, then you will behave in a way that objectifies others. We behave, as R.D. Lang put it, we behave according to the way we experience the world. And our perceptions affect our behavior, and our storytelling affects our perceptions. So if we change the order on that, our storytelling affects our perceptions affect our experience affects our behavior. So we can say that our storytelling leads to behavior. And then it's a mutually reinforcing cycle. But then the behavior shows the stories that you then once again hear. And I don't remember who it was who said this. Some Scottish balladeer said, if I could write all the stories, I wouldn't care who makes the laws. Because once again, you're going to, if you can control the narratives by which other people live their lives, then you're going to control their behavior. Control's too strong. If you're going to, I kind of like the word, it's a big word, but I kind of like it, overdetermine. That narrative overdetermines our behavior, deeply influences, whatever word you want to use. Okay, so for example, if the stories that you tell value money over living beings, then you can come to believe that money is more important than living beings. And if the stories that you are told tell you that what is most sacred is somewhere far out in heaven and the earth is a place of sin, then you can treat the earth as a place of sin and badness and temptation. And this is true on every level. I really like watching like BBC mysteries, but I recognize as I'm watching these that it's pro-police state propaganda, because the police are always right, the police always win. And there's this great book called Gunfighter Nation by Richard Slotnick. The central point of this book is, or the theme of the book, is that he follows popular fiction from, I don't know, the 1780s up through the, through the Vietnam War. And he shows a theme that is common in the popular fiction from the beginning till now, which is we're actually good people and we always fight fair, but the other side, they fight dirty. So just this once, we have to fight dirty. In the 1780s, 1790s, 1800s, 1810s, 1820s, you see that the white people always want to fight fair and we're fundamentally good people. But those damn Indians, they cheat and they fight dirty. And so just this once, we got to fight dirty. Okay, fast forward. And we get to, there are other enemies in between. And the next one I really remember is, he gives some examples of the Spanish-American War. How, you know, the United States wants to fight fair, but those Filipinos, you know, they fight dirty, so we got to fight dirty. And consequently, you end up with literally 10% of the Filipino population being massacred and mass rampant torture. You know, fast forward again to Vietnam. You know, we want to fight clean, but those damn Vietnamese, they fight dirty. And we hear the same rhetoric today. You know, of course, the United States does not want to fight unfair, but those terrorists, you know, they fight dirty. So we got to just this once. It's the same theme. It's exactly the same theme in the Dirty Harry movies. Dirty Harry wants to be clean, but, you know, those criminals, they fight by the wrong rules. 24. We don't want torture, but, and so that narrative has been, you know, hell, now that I think about it, we can probably say the same thing about the Bible, you know? We want to fight fair. We, the chosen people, want to fight fair, but those others, they're heathens. So anyway, the point is that those narratives definitely affect our lives, and we can see those narratives everywhere. There's a couple more examples of this real quick. One of them is, one of the lines I say in all my talks is, there's a great line by a Canadian lumberman, when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. If you look at trees, you see trees, you treat them another way. And I saw an example of this in the local paper during the last crab season, which was the local harbor master said that the reason that the crabbers are working so hard is because, he said, imagine that there's all these envelopes, each crab's worth about $1.50 in this economy. And he said, imagine if there's all these envelopes stuffed with $1.50 just lying all over the ground. You're going to pick up as many as you can. Well, the thing is, crabs aren't envelopes stuffed with dollar bills. Crabs are living beings whose lives are just as precious to them as yours is to you. But how do you convince yourself to participate in this mass atrocity? And this ties to Robert J. Lifton's, one of his big deals about how before you can commit any mass atrocity, you have to have what he calls a claim to virtue. You have to actually convince yourself and others that what you're doing is a good thing. So the narrative by which the Nazis were able to commit mass murder and genocide was that they were actually purifying the Aryan race. They were not actually committing mass murder. The, you know, we see these narratives, the manifest destiny narrative. You know, the United States was not committing genocide. The Europeans and the Americans were not committing genocide against the Americans, against the American Indians. I mean, there's the level to which that propaganda goes. You know, this kind of cracks me up whenever I do a talk up in Canada, because I feel really embarrassed saying something about Americans. And, you know, it's like the people in the United States are the only ones who really exist. You know, nobody in Mexico or Brazil or Canada.
I noticed it a lot just in news. When I lived in the States and I watched American news, you heard virtually nothing about the neighbors. And the same thing when I went to England and I lived there for a while. It was the same thing. The news was very self-centered, put it bluntly, and there was no news really that much about, except for the United States. That would be the only thing that would be a lot of news from. And you can see that even on the BBC now. You go there and you go to the Americas. And really, unless there's somebody, you know, massive disaster in one place or another, they're really just talking about the U.S.
Well, two things. Yeah, I agree. Two things about that. One is just today, mass protests, including violent protests in Tunisia, caused the, quote, president, end quote, to flee the country. Why is this not mentioned on the news? And, you know, there's about 500 dead in Brazil from floods, and that's not really top of the news either. The other day, okay, I'm making up this example, but this is along the same lines as what really happened. Oh, okay, what they were talking about on the news, this part's real, is they were saying, what will Bristol Palin do now that Dancing with the Stars is over? Where does she go next? And the little ticker tape running across the bottom was talking about, you know, some catastrophe somewhere in the world. And so what Bristol Palin does next, of course, is worth having three or four people talk about. Well, you know, and honest to goodness news was down at the bottom. Right. Okay, so I want to go to your second question. You know, now that we've sort of established the importance of narrative, when I was writing Culture Make-Believe, I mean, the book really started off to be a 5-page introduction to an encyclopedia of hate groups. And I asked the question, what's a hate group? And the book exploded. The reason it exploded is because the first thing I did is I went to a KKK website, and I saw that the KKK does not declare itself to be a hate group. It declares that it is a love group, and because it loves whites. And so I was thinking, okay, either A, the KKK is not a hate group, or B, you can't trust rhetoric. And then the world just exploded, because if you go just by the numbers, then the biggest racist segregationist organization in the United States is the judicial and penal system, because it's achieved segregation of African-American males on a scale the KKK can only dream of. Okay, so this is all just starts swirling around in my head, and I don't know where to go with it. And finally, where I came to is that any hatred felt long enough no longer And when we think about hatred, usually we think about sort of, you know, red faces and just buffoons shouting white power in, you know, mush mouth accents. But I realized that any hatred felt long enough no longer feels like the sort of burning hatred that we can feel. Instead, it can feel like economics. It can feel like the dominant narrative. It can feel like the stories we tell. It can feel like religion. It can feel like science. It can feel like, you know, any of these different stories that we tell that perpetuate our way of life. Any hatred felt long enough gets so internalized that it's just utterly normalized. And you can't imagine something any other way. It's like George Gerbner did. He used to be the TV violence guy. He studied television violence for years. You know, whenever anybody says there are X number of violent acts on television per day, they're citing him. And he said that most people would misinterpret his findings. He studied like for 40 years. He said people would misinterpret it. That he said the point actually is not how much violence there is on television. The point actually is who does what to whom.
Right.
Because violence is a social act. And so what he was really interested in is if you have a white male, they can usually commit violence with impunity. You know, Bruce Willis, if you see him in a movie, if he kills, or Clint Eastwood, you know, if either one of those people kills 15 people in the first half hour, this is an action movie. On the other hand, if you have a woman who from the beginning commits an act of violence, and this has changed over the last few years, then the whole movie has to be about why would she do something so outrageous? And now, you know, you have La Femme Nikita, and then you've got Kill Bill, and you've got all sorts of other movies where females are taking on those roles. But unfortunately, the women in those roles are usually, you know, they're not doing sort of righteous ass kickery. They're simply acting out the sort of patriarchal roles. So the important thing is that, you know, if I can reference back to Endgame, then, you know, the fourth premise of Endgame, that violence only flows down the hierarchy. And that's what we see reinforced constantly in the narratives that we're handed. Anyway, so I can go wherever you want with that. What was your third question? You had three questions there.
Then your last article with Orion magazine there, where we have people who believe that economic growth can happen forever, infantata. You know, just go with it, and just it goes forever. I was just sort of wanting to tie some of that, the same kind of the stories that we tell ourselves, also that fit around that same idea of privilege. And the reinforce privilege that people feel that they have and should have.
Well, the sort of central realization of that particular essay was that it occurred to me that this culture's notion of infinite economic growth. Well, we'll take it step by step. First off, you hear this constantly that economic growth is one of these narratives that is taken for granted, and it is by definition unsustainable. I mean, you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. It doesn't take any sort of cognitive giant to figure that out. And it's the same with population growth. It's the same with anything. You can't have infinite growth on any finite place. And this actually is true for science's perception of infinite growth, too, that they think that they can just keep increasing their knowledge forever. Their particular form of knowledge, I want to be very clear that science is one form of knowledge as relationship is another form of knowledge. And indigenous, I don't want to say just indigenous knowledge, because there are 10,000 different types of indigenous knowledge. You know, there's the Tolowa knowledge, and there's the Anishinaabeg knowledge, and there's the Dakota knowledge, and those are all different. Anyway, the point is that I was thinking about the notion of especially infinite economic growth, and I realized that it's based on the same premises or one of the same foundations as abuse. And what I mean by that is that a central part, a sort of a foundation of abuse is a refusal to allow another to have a boundary. It's a refusal to acknowledge limits set by any other. Infinite growth is, by definition, not allowing any other, including the planet itself, including physical reality, to set any boundaries. It's a refusal to allow any sort of limit on one's behavior. And that's really the definition, or one of a very good definition, I think, of abusive behavior, is a refusal to allow any limits on one's behavior. And the way this ties back to narrative is that, you know, one of the central themes of the dominant culture's main narratives is that of infinite growth. That's almost entirely accepted within the mainstream, but that is something that is unquestioned. Wow, the economy only grew by 0.2% this year. That's terrible. And I'm making up the numbers. You know, China had a 10% growth last year or whatever. That's great. What that is an explicit acknowledgement that you're not allowing limits.
You, now that you mention it, because like you said, the latter part of it was about the abuse and the abuser and how the only way you can stop the abuser is to actually make it so he can't abuse. Do the stories of the dominant culture actually support and back up abuse?
Well, a great example of this, and one that I use at many of my talks, is what do the movies Dr. Zhivago, On the Waterfront, Straw Dogs, V for Vendetta, what do they all have in common? There's a bunch of others. And one of the things they all have in common is that they play out the standard pornographic rape fantasy that when a woman says no, she doesn't really mean it. And how that plays out in Dr. Zhivago, for example, is that Evgrav is raping Lara. At the beginning of the scene, she's pushing him away. And by the end of the scene, she's pulling him close. And what that's telling readers is no doesn't mean no. I saw an example of this just about a week ago. I was flipping through the channels, and I saw some HBO program called Spartacus Blood and Sand. It's really very, very loosely based on Spartacus. It's really wretched. I've seen a little bit of it before. It's poorly done on every level. And there was a scene in which this slave started to, a gladiator slave, started to rape one of the free Roman women. Within about, 20 or 10 seconds or something, she was getting off on it and really enjoying it. How does that narrative teach people how to behave? So yeah, absolutely, it reinforces abuse on every level, from that level to the level of treating non-humans. I mean, in almost all books, the land is treated as background. It's landscape. It's not a character. And what does that teach us? That the land essentially is stage material. So that's reinforced all the time. That's one of the things that I wanted to do. And I haven't actually, I'd forgotten that I did this, but that was one of the things that I very consciously attempted to do in the book Songs of the Dead, is to make the land one of the characters in the book. And I wanted to, when I first conceptualized the novel, and I thought about it for 7 or 8 or 10 years before I wrote it, I wanted to write a novel in which the land was not merely backdrop, to try to change that dominant narrative a little bit.
Can you go into a little more detail on to how the dominant culture makes hatred invisible?
Well, I think it's through those stories. I think that that's a lot of it. If you're told the story often enough, you just come to accept it as part of reality, and it doesn't seem strange to you anymore. In contrast, growing up in a culture where it is routine that it is expected that people will hear messages from trees, and contrast that with another culture where it is routine that people do not hear messages from trees. And, you know, we can take, you know, that example, or we can take any example. You know, you have one culture where, I mean, how many people who wear ties think about putting on the tie every morning? They probably don't think about it. They probably just tie it. That's not, how many people think about how insane it is to work for, you know, take the Bachman-Turner overdrive lines to get up every morning from your alarm clock's warning and take the 8:15 to the city. How many people think about how crazy that is? How many people think about how crazy it is to actually pay rent, to pay for food? I mean, those are all, the reason that we accept those is because we've been told stories again and again and again. I mean, okay, and I'm not going to do the standard atheist thing here. I'm sort of, but I'm not an atheist. That, you know, how weird is it to think about, you know, there are a lot of people who think that the world was made in 7 days, that woman is made from the man's rib. There's a lot of people who think that's true. And the reason they think that's true is because they've heard it 800 bazillion times. I think that there are, I mean, the thing that's going to separate me then from the atheists is that I think that a lot of the scientific stories are just a silly. The point being that if you hear a story a bunch of times, you come to believe it. When I was in my 20s, late 20s and early 30s, I used to put all sorts of affirmations all over my walls just because I thought if I saw all the time, you know, you're a really good writer, that I would come to believe it. That's how we learn. One of the things when I was a high jumper, one of the things I used to do is I would put the bar up at what my goal was for the season when I would be just warming up or stretching or anywhere in the building or anywhere when it was outside, anywhere outside. I would put the bar up where my goal was so that when I saw it there in a meet, I wouldn't get scared. I wanted to get used to it, and I wanted to normalize it. So that's how things become invisible, is they become normalized. And this is true for good things, bad things. It doesn't matter. It just becomes a part of your life. I mean, I've never had children, but I'm guessing that once you have a kid and once you are used to having this child who is dependent upon you, then that no longer becomes something that's unusual, but it's just part of your life.
Can we change our stories? And then how would you go about doing that? Is that a possibility?
I think stories can change on certain levels. I mean, obviously, They can, because you end up with different cultures. This culture's stories have changed. You know, at one point, this culture was sustainable, 12,000, 15,000 years ago. And so, yeah, stories can change. I think that they change through repetition of the new version. They change through reinforcement. Another thing that occurs to me is, oh gosh, who was this? Max Planck? Some scientist said that the way science changes its stories is not because one side convinces the other, but because the other side dies out. So at one point, I think the example that he gave, whoever it was who said it, was at one point people believed in, what, the planetary model of atoms, and now they believe in a different model of atoms.
Right.
Didn't change because the one version convinced the people who believed the other version. It changed because the other people just grew old, and the new people had learned a new story. And that's part of how it changes. I think it changes through social reinforcement. I mean, and certainly, through, like I said, repetition. I mean, that's one of the reasons that propaganda, that the propaganda on television is so incessant, is because it needs to be repeated again and again and again. And I think that some of the stories need to be repeated a lot because they are so insane. They don't make any sense. I mean, the notion of economic growth, once again, on a finite planet, makes no sense whatsoever. We could go through a whole long list.
So how do we go about making those changes then? Is that part of it? I mean, part of it is a lot of what the work that you're doing is trying to change, making people aware of the you know, one, the insanity of the stories we're telling ourselves, and then two, some of the ways that we can be thinking differently. But how else do we, are there other ways that we can do that?
Well, there's another thing I'm thinking too, is that the form of a narrative can also help overdetermine, really, might be using that word wrong, but anyway, can help constrain what can be told through that story. You know, this is just the old medium is the message in many ways. John Livingston was the one who really helped me understand that we humans are living in an echo chamber. Echo chambers drive people insane because of sensory deprivation, that most of us, most of the time, most of our sensory perceptions, I almost said sensory inputs, and how's that for machine language insinuating itself into our lives?
Right.
But most of our sensory perceptions are either generated by or mediated by human beings and by machines, even worse, such that I see, because we're on Skype, you know, I can see you and you can see me. Everything I see is, I don't see you have, I don't see any living beings except once I saw a cat tail.
Yeah.
that's the only not explicitly human fabricated thing that I see in that being that I see in that room. And you don't see anything. It's not made by humans in this room. Both of us are inside, you for far better reason than I, given the temperature there. You know, where does the wind play in this? And it can be really easy to believe that only, you know, two guys speaking into microphones actually have something to say, if that's what you hear all the time. And guys was intentional, as opposed to the wind having something to say or the trees having something to say. So one of the ways you change it is also by changing people's experience and by, I mean, you know, getting people outside more. People ask me all the time, how do you listen to the natural world? And I always say, listen. I mean, that's where it starts. Yeah, and it's one of the things that's really hard is I think of the Upton Sinclair line, it's hard to make a man understand something when his job depends on him not understanding it. There's a, you know, I think about it, it's hard to get people to attempt to hear a different narrative when they are socially rewarded for that narrative. And the narrative, the dominant narrative, that the world was created so that you and I could speak into microphones and communicate at a long distance and sit in our respective rooms, is a thoroughly embedded itself into the psyches of nearly all civilized humans. Also, we are socially, not just socially, but we are rewarded for having that belief and for living according to it. Because as you said before we got on air here, minus how cold there?
Minus 20. Yeah.
So it's really cold. There are many, many wonderful things about indigenous ways of being, and we have each in our own way have discussed these many times, but that doesn't alter the fact that right now you are probably warmer than you would have been if you would have been living there 500 years ago. And that, all other things being equal, but of course all other things, and this is a point I make in many of my books, that all other things aren't equal, and this ability of you to be nice and toasty warm and for me to be nice and toasty warm and dry is killing the planet, and all other things, you know, aren't equal. That doesn't alter the fact that this sort of, these sorts of comforts and elegancies are, I think, really, really addictive. People can create entire, and have created entire worldviews that buttress this sense of entitlement. And they spend tremendous amounts of moral and psychic and every other type of energy avoiding the fact that all other things aren't equal, and that your particular and my particular comforts and elegancies come at the expense of the planet, of the poor, non-humans. And then, of course, the next, people who understand that, a lot of times there's another narrative that runs through this culture, which is that we must do everything we can to, it's an unspoken narrative, really. See, that's part of the problem, is we're really, in many ways, only talking about the spoken narratives. But when you get into a situation, it ends up much more problematic. There's Artie Lang's great lines, which are about what are the three rules of a dysfunctional family or a dysfunctional culture. Rule A is don't. Rule A1 is rule A does not exist. And rule A2 is never discuss the existence or non-existence of rules A1 or A2. And what this means is those stories are so deeply embedded that you cannot talk about them. Cannot. And so one of the stories that's very deeply embedded, one of the things I said in Endgame is that within any abusive dynamic, every action is set up to protect the abuser. We cannot look at how the abuser is benefiting from the behavior. So one of the ways that translates to the larger scale is that when people realize that this way of life is ubiquitously destructive, there are many people who say, well, what that means is that you should live simply. So why don't you just turn down your thermostat and, you know, put on your parka and get your, I guess you can't use a down sleeping bag anymore, but you know, you personally should decrease your economic standard of living. But the problem is that you doing that is not going to stop the tar sands. There are no personal solutions to the social problems. But the point is that it's so deeply embedded in our thinking about these issues, this notion that we can't look up the hierarchy for the problems, and all that means all we can do is change our own behavior. We can't change the institutional problems. So we end up creating all sorts of other very bizarre narratives that cause us to think that no change is possible, or that all you can do is change yourself, or that there will be this magic transformation where suddenly everybody's going to realize that they all need to live in the cold. But if you know anything about the logic of addiction, you know it's not going to work, because we're addicted to these comforts and elegancies. We as a culture, I'm not meaning you and me particularly. Oh, yeah, this guy Robert Coombs or something, it's unquestioned authorities, the real unquestioned assumptions of the real authorities of any culture.
Right.
I love that.
Yeah, it's a great line as well. And it says a lot about a lot of the things that are going on right now. In the book Lies Less Valuable, there's a great line that says, fear is the belief that we have something to lose. I wonder if you can talk about that a bit more. Maybe set up the scene a little bit, but then, you know, go into it a little bit more about fear is the belief that we have something to lose.
Well, there's two characters talking right then, and one of them sort of represents a bit more radical perspective. Malia recognizes that the system is unworkable, that the system is rigged to favor those in power, and the whole, you know, permitting system. And she works against toxics in the inner city. She recognizes that the same people who write the regulations are the ones who benefit from the regulations in many cases. And so she recognizes that the whole system is just messed up. There's another guy that she's talking to, Dennis, who's more of a mainstream environmentalist, who thinks if we can just get enough people aware of what's going on, that something good will happen. And you know, he's really happy because he was just able to get 60 Minutes interested in a story of what's happening to all the kids being poisoned in the city. And he thinks that'll change everything. And they're talking at one point, and I mean, it's pretty interesting because she's the more revolutionary character, and he actually gets the best line in the book. I don't remember exactly what they're talking about, but he comes up with that line that fear is the belief that we have something left to lose. That is probably my favorite line in the book, and I think it's true on almost every level. Even if we're scared, you know, if you're driving and all of a sudden, you know, your car pitches over a cliff, you're probably terrified, if you are terrified, which I presumably would be, because you have your life to lose.
Yeah,
and this is true for, you know, going to prison. Why is anybody afraid of going to prison? Because they would lose their liberty. And I think that, unfortunately, fear guides much of our resistance in a negative sense. I don't mean fear of what this dominant culture can do and is doing to the planet, but instead fear of what could happen to us if we resist. I've asked people in talks, and this is even at a huge talk, like 700 or 800 people, where you know, it's not self-selected to, you know, the three people who've read every one of my books and can tell me what's on page 261 of Endgame or something. This is a much larger audience, many of whom don't really know my work. I've asked, do you censor yourself because of fear of government reprisals? And I'll get 70 or 80% of people saying yes. And this is even a few years ago, before things got much, much worse with United States FBI infiltration of environmental organizations. I think that much of our lack of resistance comes from the fact that we're all afraid, that many of us are afraid of government reprisals.
One of the things I was thinking about, too, as you were talking about the fear of things, is the fear of, I wouldn't have this house and warmth over my head when it's that cold outside. You know, that as well. I mean, when people stop and think about, it's that cold outside, what's that mean to... I remember thinking that last year, actually, last winter. I'm going, it's minus 35 outside, and this is what people live with on a regular basis. What does that mean? How is that affecting people's decisions about whether to resist or not? Then that's when people start saying, well, you're crazy if you want to go, quote, backwards to a different age.
Well, I think that it does. It affects certainly the narratives as to what is considered even possible, because that line is thrown out quite often about my work. When I say that this culture is unsustainable, there have been a fair number of people who immediately respond to that simple statement, which is undeniably true. They'll say, well, what do you want to do? Go back to the Stone Age? You want to live in caves? You know, never mind the racism of that statement, in terms of implying that indigenous people are, quote, cavemen, end quote. But there's also this tremendous fear of losing this personal, physical luxury. Although I have to tell you, you know, it may be different up there since it's so cold, but frankly, when I was saying here that I wouldn't be as warm and I would also be wet, I mean, that's kind of nonsense anyway, because the truth is, if I were a Talua person 1,000 years ago, I probably would have been in my plank and brush hut or brush house anyway.
Right. Yeah, and here actually people would be in much warmer clothes than what it was, because I did an interview with a gentleman from Northwest Territories, Henry Basil. He was describing his own elders, the change in them, and he said, and the elder was saying to him, my blood and my bones come from the land, but my food and my clothes don't anymore, so I'm changing. Like they were looking at saying, I'm physically changing because of how I eat now and how I've dressed myself. And the other thing that Henry pointed out was that I go buy a winter coat now, but it's not as warm as the caribou coat I used to wear. So, you know, there's obviously differences even there, and that we don't understand that even what people were wearing before was probably in some ways better for the environment that they were in anyway than what we're wearing now, because most people, you don't even go outside in this weather unless they absolutely have to, which they do for work, but they, you know, very quickly go from one spot to another.
I don't know how it was up there, but I remember reading about the central coast of California, where it's not even that cold. They would spend most of the winter indoors in the longhouses anyway, and I'm guessing that most of the people spent most of the time indoors through the winter there, and you could probably make it pretty toasty because probably most of the dwellings were either smaller, or for a longhouse, it's you know, it's for a community, so you have you're heating up just one family space.
Right. This is another narrative. How much information? How much we would lose if we lose civilization? And I think about, wow, how much we've already lost as a result of civilization.
Yeah, and it's true. I mean, human languages are disappearing at a relatively even faster rate than wild species of animals.
Right.
What is lost with the loss of every language, and what is lost with the relationships that each would have, that each people would have with their surroundings and with the plants, with the animals, that's all being lost. I don't think it's accurate to say, I've had some disagreements with scientists, especially about this, who they say that there's been this huge explosion of knowledge in the last several hundred years. And I actually don't agree. I think that there's been a huge explosion of one sort of knowledge and a drastic reduction of other sorts on every level, from the personal to the most ecological. And an example on the personal would be, even within this culture, 100 years ago, I think a lot more people would have known how to build a house. 150 years ago, a lot more people would have known how to gather or hunt food. And I'm not just talking about indigenous people. I'm talking about even white people. There would have been a lot better chance 150 years ago. Let's go 300 years ago. You know, anybody not in a city would have known. And I deal with this in a book I have coming out this spring where this guy, Sam Harris, is talking about how Christianity is so stultifying, and any Christian from 500 years ago, if they were resurrected now, would be just considered an ignoramus, to use his word. First off, even on his own level, he's wrong, because, and I listed off a whole bunch of, you know, William of Ockham's razor, and a bunch of other people who are smart according to the scientific perspective, and or knowledgeable. But then I really sort of upped the stakes again and said, you know, almost any, right now, and I'm asking this of the listeners to this radio too, if you don't look on the internet, when's the next new moon? I almost guarantee that 500 years ago, almost everyone would have known when the next new moon is. How long would it take you? Could you catch, kill, clean, and cook a rabbit? Almost everybody in the country 500 years ago probably would have been able to do that. What local plants would be useful for contraceptives? Probably 500 years ago, most rural women would have had an idea. And locally, I can't answer any of those questions. I couldn't catch a rabbit if my life depended on it, which is the point. You know, so the form of knowledge has really changed. It used to be, I mean, I've seen studies before that children routinely can identify the jingles from 100 different corporations. They can identify, you know, 300 different corporate logos, but they can't identify 10 species of birds. So one form of knowledge has exploded in this case, and another form of knowledge has dramatically decreased. And the movement in this form of knowledge is the knowledge has become more abstract. I know, for example, that the capital of Mongolia is Ulaanbaatar, but I don't know where the local bears that I see every summer, I don't know where they den. I don't know the frogs who live in the pond during the spring and summer. I don't know where they live in the winter. I have no clue. But I know all these things about places far away, but I don't know anything about here.
What stories do you think are helping? You already touched a little bit on this already on the resistance part, but we'll just maybe take it a little further. What stories do you think are helping and hurting the resistance movement today?
What movement?
Well, the resistance movement.
Wait, are you located in the Niger Delta? Are you located in Tunisia? Are you located somewhere else?
Well, let's pretend there's one in North America.
What is this thing you are talking about? Okay, I think there's a bunch of stories that hurt it. One of them is that we can spend our way to sustainability. One of them is that capitalism can be sustainable. One of them is that capitalism is not the enemy. One of them is that lifestyle change is sufficient to... That lifestyle change equals social change. That lifestyle change is sufficient to... Lifestyle change can substitute for organized political resistance. Another one is that those in power have our best interests at heart. Another one is that civilization is desirable. Another one is that everyone in the world needs to live at a U.S., Canadian, European standard of living. That is possible. When people ask me what would it take, I always say 10 more planets. Oh, here's another one that's really harmful, that resistance is not possible, that those in power are somehow utterly invincible. And do you know what one of the strongest recruiting tools in the French resistance in World War II was? It was the invasion in Normandy, because it was the realization, the actualization, the understanding that the Nazis weren't invincible. And as soon as the resistance members realized that the Nazis were not invincible, then they started coming out in droves. So the belief that this way of living cannot be changed, the way of the belief that, and then there's the any stories also, here's a very important thing. You know, I've said this so many times that what all the so-called solutions to global warming have in common is they accept industrial capitalism as a given, and they say that the world must conform to industrial capitalism. So first off, one of the things that harms the resistance is the belief that the natural world is not primary. And that leads to any story that causes our loyalty to not be with the victims of this culture is harmful to the resistance. That stories that will help the resistance need to help us shift our loyalty and our identity away from having loyalty to and identifying with that which is killing the planet. So making our loyalty a story that would help us have our loyalty be with the poor of India, the poor farmers in India who are being driven off their land for Coca-Cola, the indigenous who are fighting against exploitation of their land bases everywhere, the women who are victims of patriarchy. Any stories that can help us shift our allegiance to those victims can help the resistance. I don't want to ruin the ending of Lives Less Valuable for anybody who hasn't read it, but there's a little thing in an epilogue, you know, stuff happens, and I'm not going to tell people what. And then this one character, remember the scene at the bus stop after the whole climax mm-hmm. scene? Then there's a scene where Malia goes back and she sees Simon, and he was going to come up and mug her, but then he doesn't because he recognizes her. And then he asks one question right at the end, which is, I got to ask, did it make a difference? And she says, I mean, I'm not going to tell the details, but she says, yes, it made a difference. And that's very important, too, the recognition that you can affect some change. Because that's one of the stories they tell us again and again, is once again, those in power are an unstoppable force. And if you believe those in power are an unstoppable force, that's one of the reasons that the lifestylists have gained so supreme, is because A, they don't threaten power, and B, because they've come to believe that narrative that you cannot affect change, and therefore what you need to do is just make your own life, live your own life as pure as possible. But if you can affect change, then that purity becomes really secondary. So stories that reinforce the understanding that things can be different and that we can affect change. And once again, I'm not talking about affecting change on your own personal consumption, which, you know, is fine. I'm not saying people shouldn't do that, but that's not where the real action is. And one of the things we need are some victories. I think that those can really encourage people to know that the dominant culture is not unstoppable.
I'm just wondering, because some of the thoughts I've had about, and I think that you're, you know, the joke at the beginning of the whole question of about helping the resistance in movement today is actually a very important one. One of the things I worry about or think about is that somehow we haven't created a culture or a place or being a space for that to really foment or even grow. And I think there may be some talk around it not being possible. I guess that maybe that ties back into what you were saying before as well. I think part of the, you know, when we talk about knowledge, I guess what I'm thinking back to, I was sitting down with some activists and chatting with them after an event last year, and I was looking at this fellow. He had taken a whole bunch of pictures when he was in Ireland, in Northern Ireland, and I think most of these murals were in Northern Ireland. But there was mural all about resistance, and they were not just Irish resistances, but they were about Caribbean resistances and French resistance and German and all these different places that there had been resistances. And there were stories and the faces of the people were there, and they were throughout history. They weren't any specific point of history, but there was all these murals all over the place. One, I thought it was great that that was just being allowed. I mean, like, they could just do that. And then the other thought was that how much easier it is for them to reinforce resistance ideas when they have that being reflected back to them all over. And how I think what we get constantly put back as what is resistance here often ends up to being reflections of anarchy or reflections of bravado, but no none of that sort of community collective
organized disciplined resistance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which you definitely got a sense of from these pictures. Like there was more than, it was obviously that there was some degree of hierarchy, there was some degree of community where people were working together in different ways here within that. Like these murals were not just a single image, there were many images.
I think that's really, really important. And I think we need to learn those stories of resistance. And why is it, well, it's pretty obvious, in the United States, that the only resistance or revolutionary movements that we can really talk about are the, you know, American revolutionaries of 1776. And that's the only one that ever really exists. We don't have this history of, you know, the Haymarket martyrs and who helped bring about the 8-hour workday. You know, we don't have the Wobblies. We don't have all this long and rich history. For the most part, I mean, yeah, there are, people do see it, and it's out there, and there's, you know, People's History of the United States, and it's really, that book was very important to my political awakening, and there's all sorts of, there are those histories, but they're not in your face like those murals that you're talking about, and those need to be more present, and we need to be seeing those stories all the time. I mean, that was one of the good things about Avatar, is it showed resistance. You know, of course, the resistance is on an entirely different planet than this one. You know, and that's a sort of standard liberal position of resistance is okay as long as it's done by people of a different color, in this case, blue. You know, as long as it's done by people of a different color somewhere a long ways away, then resistance is acceptable. Did I ever tell you the story about what happened with the Nation and my interview with the Tupac Amaristas?
No.
Oh, it was pretty funny. I interviewed a member of the MRTA back in 1997, and this is when, or 1996, whenever it was, 97, I think, when they took over the Japanese ambassador's house in Peru. Not somebody inside, obviously. I interviewed an exile, somebody who was an exile in Germany, and I sent a query to the Nation magazine asking them if they would like a write-up of this, and they were really excited, and then the editor called me and she was tremendously excited about this article I was going to write, until I happened to say something really stupid, which was, part of what I wanted to do with the article is to show that resistance is possible not only in South America, but also that we need to bring this home and we need to take down capitalism here. At that point, she said, yeah, this idea is really, really interesting, but I just realized I need to talk to our board of directors about it. I need to really think about it with the editorial board. And so I like the idea a lot. Let me call you back. And then I got an email like 3 hours later saying, actually, we're not interested. And the moment, I could just tell from the tone of voice, the moment at which she was no longer interested in the story was the moment when I wasn't talking about some poor brown people in South America, but instead something actually happening at the center of empire.
You have a new book coming out called Dreams. So can you give us an idea what it's about and maybe some teasers about it?
You know, in many of my books, I've talked about how the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that indigenous peoples would generally would perceive the world not as consisting of resources to be exploited, but instead other beings to enter into relationship with. And that's part of the difference. But another part of the difference is that I've asked a bunch of indigenous people, and I've never heard of any indigenous culture that is atheistic. That many indigenous cultures would have relations with their ancestors, with spirits. I mean, not just a tree would talk to you, but a spirit, you know, whatever that means. The book is really about, well, why don't I read like the first page or something?
Sure.
And I might give an idea about what the book's about. Okay. For many years, I've wanted to write a book about the mutually beneficial and extremely complex relationships between dreaming and waking realities. But each time I'd finish a book and begin preparing for this one, some other book would suddenly demand my attention, and this one would get pushed aside. Then this year, this book made clear in ways we'll explore in the book itself that it was to be next. There was to be no more delay. And then it hit me. Part of the reason this culture is killing the planet is that it ignores, devalues, or demonizes messages from those places where writing comes from, where dreams come from, where so many other impulses and ideas and beings come from. It's like, it's only a product of the last 400 or 500 years, now I'm speaking instead of reading, it's only a product of the last 400 or 500 years that people, really the Enlightenment, don't you love that term, where people have believed that they actually write their own books. Prior to that, it was always believed that a muse would write books. Genius actually comes from a word that has to do with place. That would be a genius of a place. It would be a being who lives in a place. And that there's this notion of, I mean, that's one of the things that prompted me to write this book, is that it's long been clear to me that the muse is an actual being. When I talk about a muse writing my books for me, I'm not talking about my unconscious. I'm talking about some other being on some other side. Anyway, it tries to create a rigid separation between what it calls the human on one hand and what it calls the natural, and especially the supernatural on the other, or what it calls the supernatural. It then favors what it calls the human at the extreme expense of everyone else. So the book is really about an exploration of other sides, of are there beings on other sides who can help us stop this culture? And then, you know, the biggest argument against there being beings on other sides who could help us stop this culture is the fact that this culture is killing the planet and they haven't stepped in. And one of the central questions of the book is, if indigenous people have been right in that there are other beings out there, why haven't they helped stop this culture? And if, as I fully believe, the Earth is sentient, why hasn't the Earth stopped it? Why hasn't the Earth, you know, sent a virus to wipe out all civilized humans or something? Why did smallpox go the direction it did? And sure, we can all read Jared Diamond and, you know, see the relationship between domestication of cows and disease passage and why the Europeans had immunity to disease. We can all understand that, but that's just an explanation of how, not why. And the fact that I can explain how something works doesn't mean that there's no larger thing in action. And a great example of this, and I say this in the book, is, you know, we can describe the mechanisms by which I actually write, you know, the oxygen that I take in and how it goes into my blood and how it feeds the muscles and how the muscles move to make a pen move across a piece of paper. We can all explain that, but does that mean there's not something else going on there? And the fact that you can make an explanation for something doesn't mean that there's nothing else going on. It doesn't mean there is. So I go through a bunch of possibilities for why the dominant culture has won. One of them is that science is right and the Earth is dead matter. You know, when the indigenous peoples were praying for help, they were praying to nobody. There's nothing out there. There's the Earth is as the world, the universe is, as Richard Dawkins describes, random. That's one example. Another example, another possibility would be that the Christians are right. Maybe the Christians are right and there is one God and He wants His chosen people to take over the planet, and He's really nasty, and He pretty much hates life. And one of the reasons I say for this is because, you know, He lives way out there, and He's been living for forever, and He doesn't have a body, and, you know, several billion years, a long time to go without an orgasm, so no wonder He hates people. And then I go through a bunch of other possibilities for why the dominant culture may be winning. You know, maybe there is a God, and God is a machine, because Lord knows the machines are winning at this point. You know, this way of life is really benefiting machines more than it is humans. And I go through all sorts of things about that. I just explore the possibilities of, you know, where do dreams come from? And I do a lot of dream analysis in the book of my own dreams. And it's pretty interesting because when I was writing the book, I wasn't able to find any other. And I'm not indigenous, I want to be really clear about that, but I wasn't able to find any non-indigenous sources who treated dreams and dream interpretation as anything other than psychoanalytic.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's really interesting.
They all treat dreams as manifestations of your unconscious, but I perceive them as, yes, they could be manifestations of one's unconscious, and they could also be messages from somewhere else. And I talk about a lot of synchronous things that I've had this happen so many times where I've had precognitive dreams. I dream something that happens later. Or I've had dreams where I even have a term for this. It's happened so often. I call it leakage, where I'll have a dream that doesn't make any sense to me until I'll talk to a friend a day or two later who lives in another state. And what I dreamt about something that happened to them that didn't. A great example that's actually true, I mean, that's physically true, this isn't just made up, is that I had a dream which I understood everything, except at one point there was this blue car zoomed by and almost hit me or something.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand that. I tried to figure out, okay, the first car I ever owned was blue, you know, what does blue mean to me, what do cars mean to me, blah, blah, nothing made any sense. The rest of the dream made perfect sense. And I talked to a friend of mine a couple days later. I was telling her the dream, and she said, you know, the day before that happened, I almost got hit by a blue car. And that sort of thing happens to me all the time. So what does that mean? I know a lot of people who've had these sorts of things happen pretty often. So the book is really an exploration of all those. I'll say one more thing about it, which is that in Endgame, the only premise that I really didn't 100% agree with is the premise where I say something about how we have to solve the problems that we've created all on our own, and that we won't get help from, you know, what I say there is Jesus or the Easter Bunny or...
Oh, right, yeah.
Whatever.
Right.
That premise is probably true, or I want to act as though that premise is true, but at the same time, I don't believe that there aren't any others on other sides, and I know that they can help us, and they can also hurt us as part of the problem. And that's, I'm kind of running the book, but one of the things that I really sort of come to is I think that part of the reason the dominant culture has won is because there are beings on other sides, and there are beings that include some who wish us well, some who don't wish us well. You know, they're all over the map, and some of them don't care about us. You know, we're not the point of everything. And the dominant culture has been really good at making sacrifices to some of the beings on the other sides. And those sacrifices cause them to receive assistance. And it sort of helped me understand, it sort of helped me look at a lot of the oppression of the dominant culture in a different way. That, yeah, the oppression, we can explain it sociologically and psychologically and all those other things. But in addition, it's like there are some other forces who are being fed by vivisection, by the horrors of factory farming, by the horrors of the mass rapes that characterize this culture. That's actually not merely acting as forms of terrorism or economics, but in addition, they could be feeding others who then power back. And one of the things, and this is the last thing I guess I'll say about this right now, is that one of the things that really started me thinking about that a long time ago was, you know, because I talk about various forms of resistance, one of the things I've done a lot of study of are the plots to assassinate Hitler, because if you want to make a case for militant resistance against anybody, you know, it's pretty easy to start with that. And, you know, everybody who knows anything about World War II pretty much accepts that had Hitler been taken out of the equation, that, you know, whether through capture or killing, the war would have either not happened or would have stopped. And Hitler was also very popular. But the point is that there were something like 45 different attempts on Hitler. I know at the end of the movie Valkyrie, they mentioned 19, but there's actually a lot more. There's about 43 or 45 or something, many of which failed for just absurd reasons. Just one night, there was a guy set a bomb. The bomb was set to go off at a time when Hitler gave a speech every year from 7:30 to 8:30. The bomb was set to go off at 8:20. And because it was foggy that night, Hitler couldn't fly out, so he had to go by train. And because the train schedule was so strange, that means he had to give a speech from 7 to 8. So had it not been foggy, he would have died. One attempt did not go off because a fly landed on somebody's hand. That caused various other things to happen. One, they actually had the bombs in a plane with Hitler, and they were set to go off when the plane reached a certain altitude, and the fuses lit, but the fuses did not set the explosives off. You know, one or two or three or four or five examples are no big deal.
Yeah.
You just got... But when you get up to 20, 30, 40 examples, like, what the hell is going on?
Right.
And so then I was thinking, you know, there were 20 million Russians killed in World War II and, 6 million Jews and another several million communists, homosexuals, Jehovah's Witnesses, all those. And, you know, those sorts of sacrifices might buy you a lot of protection. I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying that I believe that's the case. I'm just saying that the book is an exploration of that among many, many other things.
Yeah, that's kind of an uncomfortable thought, but it's, I mean, I think about it a lot because as a kid, I would sense really strong bad feelings somewhere. I don't know what it was, and I would, you know, I'd call. I remember one night just waking up and calling for my father because I didn't know. Like I just, it was so powerful, the sense of bad feeling, and he came and talked to me for a while and basically explained it away. But it was something that I really remember, that it was very, very much there, and it was very, you know, palatable. But it's somehow, I think that, you know, when you talk about, again, the stories that we tell ourselves and the things like that, we end up dismissing a lot of that as well. I was like, you said at one point, muses wrote books, now people write books. Do you, like you talk about having a muse and talking with a muse, do you find there are particular times that is more evident than others? Is there certain conditions that are in place, or have you noticed that there are certain conditions in place?
There's a line that I've always remembered from a book I read when I was a teenager, that is, the God will not speak to those who have no time to listen. And I found that for myself, having a lot of time really facilitates listening. And if I don't have a lot of time and emotional energy, then I'm not able to listen as well.
Interesting.
Well, and it also takes a lot of dedication and loyalty.
Mm.
You know, I remember reading Amy Tan, I think it was, who wrote The Kitchen God's Wife. I think it was an interview of her where somebody asked her if writing ever gets easier. And she said, no, but it gets better. And that's not been my experience. Writing's actually gotten much easier for me. And what was hard for me was finding the place where it gets easy. What was hard for me was finding the place where the door opens up so the muse can talk to me. But just like walking any path, you know, I've walked to that particular doorway enough that that door is easier to find. But it was really hard for me to find it in the first place. That was when the writing was really difficult and painful for me.
I mean, I'm really looking forward to the book because that's the kind of stuff I tend to be more interested in. Falls into a lot of my own belief systems. I mean, as soon as you talked about taking Richard Dawkins' stance that the Earth is just dead matter and da-da-da, I mean, my mind goes instantly, my experience goes instantly, that's not possible.
Well, and me too, but the problem is, like, then why the hell did the passenger pigeons get driven extinct? You know, does all this not care about the passenger pigeons?
Hmm.
You know, why isn't it stopping this incredible horror? And that's one of the things, that's a question I ask in the book. And of course, I don't have an answer. I can't have an answer because I don't have full knowledge. And that's part of what I go through in the book is that I don't, all knowledge requires faith. All knowledge requires faith. And so there's this fundamental humility of like, I will never know. All I can do is tell you what I experience and tell you my best guess. And who knows, you know?
My son got, someone gave him Stephen Hawking's, and he was reading it, and he came up to me, and he read a passage to me, and it was basically all about how the Earth was formed and how it was made. Basically, it said, you know, science says this, science says that. And he said, you know, I could take the word science and scientist out of there and put in the word God, and it would read exactly the same.
Yeah, that's really true. And that's one of the things I say, I hit again and again in that book, is that science really is one of this culture's new religions, that and capitalism.
Yeah.
But science is one of the new religions. And in fact, that's one of the things I say is that one of the things that Christianity did that was that paved the way for science is a monotheism in general. Monotheism removed all meaning from the earth and put it on a distant sky god. And then it's much easier to take the next step and just remove that meaning out there. Once Christianity's done the heavy lifting of removing meaning from all the earth.
Right, yeah. Well, that's a good point. That's a very good point. So thank you very much for your time.
Oh, gosh, thank you. It's a great interview.
That was BTO with Taking Care of Business. As usual, Derek makes a lot of great points, and I want to follow up with one particular point, and that is what he did with Songs of the Dead and made the land a character in the story. To me, this is an important point, that the land be a character in our stories, a living being in our stories, especially for those activists fighting the wheat to go up. What does Ezra Levant's Ethical Oil and the Vancouver Media Co-op's critique of NCIV have in common? They both take civilization as a given. And I think if you were to ask the boreal forest that's being slaughtered for the tar sands if there was any reason for civilization, I don't believe the boreal forest would see one, nor would any of the millions of beings being boiled alive through the Nsitsu process. I think they would prefer their lives to civilization. Jack Forbes' book, Columbus and Other Cannibals, points this out quite well. Taking us out is Hocus Pocus by Focus. Remember, folks, the resistance needs you.